how effective is it when a bystander uses a defibrillator?
Doing bypass surgery on the beating heart.
How long do red cells stay fresh in the blood bank?
And minimizing blood loss after bypass surgery.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on November 4th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And when this is aired, you will be cycling in France, so we'll reveal to our listeners that this week we're doing all online first from the New England Journal of Medicine. Since we're doing that, then, let's turn right to the stories. The one that is most compelling for me, this huge study in Japan where they took a look at bystander use of defibrillators and the impact that that had.
We've talked before about the fact that early defibrillation can play a key role in improving survival in patients that have an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest due to a particular rhythm called ventricular fibrillation. And to make these things publicly accessible can be really important because it can reduce the time to defibrillation. So this is a nationwide, prospective, population-based registry study of individuals in Japan that between 2005 and 2013 had bystander witnessed arrest, presumed to be from the heart, and resuscitation was attempted. Many of these individuals underwent defibrillation from publicly accessible defibrillators, and they compared the results between those that did and those that didn't. Of almost 44,000 patients with bystander witnessed ventricular fibrillation arrest, about 10% actually received defibrillation from a publicly accessible defibrillator. Those individuals had a much better outcome. Their likelihood of being alive and having a favorable neurologic outcome was 39% versus 18% that did not have public access defibrillation.
And I find that to be just incredibly compelling and at least calls out to me to public education saying, hey, folks, there's some pretty good results if you go ahead and attempt to use a defibrillator.
Yes. I think it's important, though, to understand that in the overall scheme of things, of all people that experienced sudden death, only about 2% of individuals in Japan benefited from this. It requires, first of all, that it be due to a cardiac origin, and only about half of sudden deaths are due to a heart origin. It requires that ventricular fibrillation be the rhythm, because that's the only rhythm that responds well to defibrillation. They have to have access to a public defibrillator, and about two-thirds of sudden cardiac deaths occur in the home rather than a public place. So overall, I agree with you. This is a really important study. People need to be aware of where the publicly accessible defibrillators are, and they're so easy to use that people shouldn't be afraid of them. But overall, only a small number of people benefit from this particular therapy.
Okay. But I still really like it, and I think it goes to the whole idea of it's better to go ahead and try it if it's available and it looks like that's what the problem is, just like CPR, than it is to not do it.
You're right. And for people who have never used one, once you take it out of the package, it tells you what to do, gives you verbal instructions. So it's easy to do for anybody that's never even used one before.
Okay. Talking more about the heart, of course, it's going to be all heart this week. Let's take a look at this ongoing issue. Gosh, it seems like as long as I've been in this medical journalism gig, we've been talking about on and off pump CABG.
And what that means to the individual that may not be familiar with this is that the time-honored way of doing surgery on the heart was that you actually open the chest, prepare the heart, and then actually stop it from beating. And to do that, you have to put the person on what's called a pump. It circulates the blood through an oxygenator while the heart's not beating. The surgery is done, and then afterwards, they remove the pump machine, and the heart started back up. More recently, we've developed techniques to actually operate on the beating heart. And the hypothesis was, by doing that, you would minimize the dangers and risks associated with putting people on a pump, things like stroke or heart attack or excessive bleeding. So this is a five-year study of over 4,700 patients that were randomized to receive either classic bypass surgery on the pump or off pump. The one-year outcome and 30-day outcome have been previously reported. This is the five-year outcome. And what they discovered was that after 5 years, the composite outcome, that is looking at stroke, heart attack, kidney failure, or even needing repeat revascularization, was the same regardless of whether the operation was conducted on the pump or off the pump. So overall, no difference between the two different techniques.
I think this is really informative, and I was happy to see this long-term outcome. One of the controversies, of course, we're familiar with is the idea that somehow the on-pump surgery results in significant cognitive decline post-surgically.
And in the individuals here in which there was neurocognitive testing, there was no difference between the two techniques. In fact, there was not even any difference with respect to cost either. So you're right. Although the hypothesis was good, is that keeping people off the pump would have a better outcome. The short term, 1 year, and the long term outcomes, 5 years, suggest there's really no better.
Interesting. So I guess this is really a call shot. How would you determine, if you had to do this yourself, what technique you would ask for?
Well, I would ask the surgeon which technique he or she was most skilled in performing, and that's the one that I would have.
Okay, excellent advice. Since we're talking about this surgery issue then, another really interesting study relative to the storage of red blood cells in the blood bank. Lots of ideas that somehow they start to become less fresh and they result in poorer outcomes, but that's not really the case.
Yep, you might imagine that using fresh blood, if you need a transfusion, might be better than using blood that's been around. Now, when I say fresh versus old, I'm talking about blood that's been obtained within a week versus blood that's been obtained up to 6 weeks. In fact, we store it and use it for up to 42 days. And there were some studies, not all, but that suggested that using the fresh blood resulted in better outcomes. So to test that, the investigators did a very pragmatic randomized control trial that was conducted at 6 hospitals in 4 different countries. And patients were randomly assigned to receive a blood transfusion that had been stored for a short period of time, that is in 11 days or less, or in a longer period of time, up to 23 days. And they looked at the primary outcome, which was mortality. That's a pretty easy outcome to measure. What they discovered was that the blood that was stored the short period of time, and I said 11, it actually should be 13 days, versus that stored for over 23 days, there was no difference in mortality between the patients who received either the short or the long-term stored blood.
I think this is excellent news because blood banks are always kind of on the edge and there are times of the year where there's a critical need for blood. So any idea that it wouldn't be able to be stored as long as it already is would have even exacerbated that situation.
Right. Now, one of the things we don't know is, again, the old blood here was about 23 or 24 days old. You might extend it further and say, well, what about the blood that's stored for 35 or 40 or 42 days? Is there a difference there? And obviously, this didn't address that. But the other thing that this study did address is these were all patients getting transfusions for different reasons. And you might say, well, are there any subsets of patients that would receive a benefit from one type of treatment or the other? And when they looked at it by different pre-specified groups, those that underwent heart surgery, for example, or those that were admitted to an intensive care unit, or those that had cancer, there was no difference at all among any of these subgroups either.
I like this. This is good news. Finally, let's turn to, since we're talking about bleeding, what about this medication, tranexamic acid, and its ability to help?
Many of our listeners may not be familiar with this. It's a medicine that's supposed to promote clotting in individuals that have had bypass surgery or any type of heart surgery. And why that's important is many of the people that are having heart surgery are on aspirin, which is, as we know, described as a, quote, mild blood thinner, and the surgery itself results in a lot of bleeding. There was some concern that the use of this clotting agent, the tranexamic acid that you mentioned, actually increased death and increased the risk of stroke. So here we have this conundrum. If we can stop bleeding, and that may be beneficial, but it may have some adverse side effects. So which is it? So to answer that question, the investigators looked at over 4,600 patients that underwent surgery, half of them assigned to receive tranexamic acid, and the other half that received placebo. And what they found is when they looked at the overall primary outcome, that is the risk of having death or some adverse effect due to clotting, such as a heart attack or a stroke or a pulmonary embolism or kidney failure, there was no difference between the two. That is those that received tranexamic acid versus those that didn't. So that not any adverse side effects there. But those that received the clotting agent reduced their use of transfusions almost by half, which is important, and reduced their need for a reoperation as well, by about 50%, a reoperation usually for bleeding. There was a slight increase in the risk of seizures from 0.1% to 0.7%, but that was overall a very minor adverse effect compared to all the beneficial things associated with its use.
Clearly, being able to reduce the need for transfusion is a really good thing because we know that even though we test all this blood for all kinds of things and all the rest of the safety things that are in place, that there's still a risk that's associated with transfusion.
Yep, a risk and a cost as well. So we can actually save a tremendous amount of blood around the country for purposes where it's really needed by using this medication. So the nice thing is it's not associated with an increased risk of death or an increased risk of significant clotting issues. So great news.
On that note then, I'm going to talk about the bystander use of defibrillators on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.